Brothers and sisters, if you don't change your ways, you are on the road to Jam Nation. Sugar. Welcome, everybody, to episode 36 of Road to Jam Nation. In this episode, I'll be revealing my top 10 favorite albums of 1969, concluding my look at the musical trends and albums of the year. But before we get into that, let's discuss this song that I opened this episode with, which was the big hit song Sugar Sugar by the Archies. The Archies were a result of a quest by music producer Don Kirshner to be able to produce pop music completely under his control. Don Kirshner had had a career of success as a music producer and label executive. And during the 1960s, he had begun a successful career working with Hollywood TV studios as a music supervisor for television shows. During the early production of The Monkees, Don Kirshner was brought in as musical supervisor for that TV show. Like the Archies, initially, the Monkees were entirely a fictitious rock band, put together with a casting call that brought in some talented performers from both the acting realm as well as the music realm, with Michael Nesmith and Peter Tork both having backgrounds in actual music performance, while David Jones had a background in acting, although as part of his acting career, he had performed in musicals. Meanwhile, Mickey Dolenz had started his career as an actor, but during the early 60s, he had also been the songwriter and lead singer for an unsuccessful rock band. When the studio created a debut album by the Monkees and began releasing singles by the group as well, the stars of the show were initially only allowed to sing on these recordings, with the actual music performed by experienced studio professionals, and the songs supplied by Brill Building-style professional songwriters. Michael Nesmith and Peter Tork were initially pretty annoyed by this, while Mickey Dolenz and David Jones were fine with it because they were actors. When the studio followed up and began having this group go out on concert tours, even Mickey Dolenz and David Jones began feeling like frauds, playing this music for large audiences as if they'd had anything really to do with it. And so, the group became united in pushing back against the producers to be allowed to participate more in the music recording and to be allowed to play their own instruments on those recordings and to begin supplying some of their own songwriting. Don Kirshner was completely unsympathetic to these requests, and he continued to put out singles that he himself chose without giving the group any participation in those choices. In order to appease the stars of their show, the producers finally wound up firing Don Kirshner. It was impossible at that point, with all the coverage in Teen Idol magazines, for the producers to simply replace members of the Monkees in order to find members that were more easily controlled. And the members of the Monkees were allowed on later albums to participate more as musicians in the recording studio and to supply more of their own songwriting. Don Kirshner came away from this experience unhumbled by his firing. He was convinced that he was still in the right, and he decided that the best way to solve this problem was to create another fictitious band, and he found a way to do this without having to worry about the egos of the kind of star power that the Monkees had. When he hooked up with the creators of Archie Comics, a long-running series of comedic teenage romance comics, Don Kirshner worked with Archie Comics to create a rock band based around the characters of the comic book. And, like he initially did with the Monkees, he hired Brill Building songwriters and the best studio musicians available to hire in order to record music as the Archies for a new animated series. The first single released under this group name had promising results, as it became a mid-level hit in 1968 when the first album by the Archies and the first single were released. the song Bang Shang A Wang went to number 22 in the United States in 1968. However, as publicity about this new fictitious cartoon band became more widespread, radio DJs in America became resistant to playing this music, feeling that they were once again being used to perpetuate fraud on the music listening public. And so the second single under the Archies name, which was released in 1968, didn't get the same amount of airplay and did not make it onto the top 40, that song being Feeling So Good, Scooby-Doo. To combat what he felt was unfair bias, Don Kirshner had the third single by the Archies delivered to radio stations by his music promotion staff without labels, so that the DJs couldn't see a band name, a song name, or even the record label it was from. These experienced music promoters invited the radio staff to simply listen to these songs as a new mystery single from what they said was a new band they were trying to break. And after hearing the obvious earworm magic of the song Sugar Sugar, the song wound up being played on a number of radio stations, even though they didn't have a name of the band yet. And the listeners of those radio stations responded immediately with praise for the new song and the request that the radio stations continue to play it. The song picked up from there, and by the time the cat was out of the bag that this was the latest single by the Archies, it was too late to stop. And Sugar Sugar would go on to spending 4 weeks at number one in America and 8 weeks at number one in England, and selling enough copies that Sugar Sugar became the top-selling song in America and in England for 1969. So, with that level of success, I thought it was important to highlight the existence of this song in order to accurately discuss the music of 1969. But, even though I myself am a fan of this great little pop tune, the album that it came off of, Everything's Archie, was not in any way a contender for my top 20 spots, because Sugar Sugar is really the only thing to recommend the Everything's Archie album that came out in 1969. Although the album also did contain that Feeling So Good Scooby-Doo song, which is also catchy in and of itself. Ultimately, despite the success of Sugar Sugar and the follow-up success of the single Jingle Jangle, which also came out in 1969 and went to number 10 in America, ultimately, the experiment of the Archies wound up being a fairly short-lived one. From 1968 through 1972, despite a string of singles, only 4 songs by the Archies ever became hits, with only 2 of those being the major hits, Sugar Sugar and Jingle Jangle. Bam Shang A Lang started out the singles of the Archies at number 22. Sugar Sugar went to number 1, Jingle Jangle went to number 10. In early 1970, the song Who's Your Baby would squeak in to number 40 on the American pop charts. But the following 7 singles after that, from 1970 to 1972, failed to hit the top 40 charts. However, while this experiment might not have turned out as wildly successful as Don Kirshner had hoped, he did go on to a long career, continuing to be a music supervisor for a number of TV shows throughout the 1970s. And he also wound up hosting his own musical variety show, Don Kirshner's Rock Show. While I might have some issues and differences of philosophies with Don Kirshner's approach to creating pop music, I am a fan of his Don Kirshner's Rock Show program. During the 1970s, that show featured pretty much every band you would have wanted to see live during the 1970s. In full actual musical performances, not simply lip-syncing as they had done on so many music variety shows of the 1960s. So, anyway, like I said, I thought I should feature Sugar Sugar in order to highlight its success in 1969, but it is not in any way important to my list of favorite albums for the year. So let's actually get into what is on my top 10 now. My number 10 favorite album of 1969 was Santana, and the album was the group's debut album, which was self-titled as Santana. As you may have heard if you listened to episode 35, 1969 seemed to have a lot of self-titled debut albums that wound up making it onto my top 20 list. This debut album by Santana introduced the world to a new rock fusion sound that linked Latin American music influences with blues, psychedelia, and jazz. The group centered around Carlos Santana's euphoric guitar leads. Carlos Santana's guitar work has always been among the most ecstatically uplifting music that I have ever enjoyed. This debut album by the group is an absolutely solid introduction to his musical approach, though it doesn't quite match the confidence and musical complexity of the band's second album, Abraxas. Carlos Santana had been born in Mexico, and he began playing professionally at a young age in the clubs in Tijuana before relocating to San Francisco. Santana's family had already moved to that city, and the developing hippie rock scene there drew Santana to join his family. Carlos washed dishes for a living, did street performances, and he began hanging out at the local music clubs until he had an opportunity to finally take the stage as part of an impromptu fill-in for a canceled appearance by Paul Butterfield. Soon after that stage debut, Carlos Santana formed a band with some of his fellow street musicians. This band began playing steadily around the San Francisco scene in 1966, and it soon caught the attention of Bill Graham, who became the band's manager. All of the things that you've done. As I mentioned last episode, in my discussion of It's a Beautiful Day, the Santana band landed a slot at Woodstock due to the insistence of Bill Graham, who wanted one of the bands that he managed on the bill in return for assisting the promoters of the event in landing the Grateful Dead. Santana was unknown at this time outside of the San Francisco club scene, having had no shows outside of California before 1969. The group's debut album was released around the same time as the Woodstock Festival was taking place. And the group's first ever performance, farther west than Salt Lake City, would take place at the Fillmore East, just 2 weeks before the Woodstock Festival. Santana's passionate performance wowed the huge crowd at the festival, and the publicity from that breakout performance helped this debut album to reach number 4 on the Billboard charts. The songs Soul Sacrifice and Jingo were both centerpieces of that Woodstock performance. But neither of those songs was particularly well-suited for pop radio play. The band would score their first hit song with the song Evil Ways, Evil Ways reached number 9 on the pop charts. This song was a cover of a song originally recorded by Puerto Rican jazz percussion player William Correa. Part of the energy of that historic Woodstock performance by Santana can be chalked up to the fact that Carlos and some of the other members of the band were frying hard at the time on LSD. Carlos has said that during his performance, his guitar turned into a snake that he had to wrestle into submission in order to perform the show. While sometimes these type of stories can be a bit of hyperbole, I personally don't think that this particular story is just some image-stoking storytelling, because if you look at the video performance of Carlos Santana playing in Woodstock, it's pretty clear that Santana's eyes are extremely dilated. It's obvious that that dude was absolutely freaking high. Anyway, it wound up working out for them, and all of that is due to the fact that the music on this album is just spectacularly good stuff. Carlos Santana was introduced to the world at large, and that's a good thing. He has pretty consistently made great music throughout his career, and his concert performances are inevitably positive, uplifting events. Let's listen to one more great song by this band now. Enjoy! Next, my number 9 favorite album of 1969. The album was by B.B. King, and it was titled Completely Well.
If you can't do no better, baby, think I'd better get me another that can. Yes, if you can't do no better, baby, think I'd better get me another that can. You know you're going around cheating on me. You ain't doing nothing but losing a good man.
The legendary blues artist B.B. King had been a consistent presence on the R&B charts since 1951. From 1951 through 1969, King had charted at least one top 40 R&B hit in every year except for 1959. But King's crossover success to pop radio had been fairly limited to this point, with only two of his songs breaking into the pop top 40, both of those songs reaching merely into the high 30s. King's albums also had not been huge sellers, with most of his success being in the singles that he had released, as well as being a popular concert draw. In the late 1960s, the management for B.B. King made the smart decision to go after the many young music fans that were being turned on to the blues by rock artists such as Eric Clapton. B.B. King was booked into rock clubs and became the opening touring act for popular rock bands that had themselves been inspired by his music. In 1969, B.B. King was opening up for the Rolling Stones on tour, and he released two new albums in 1969. The first of these albums was titled Live and Well, and that album consisted of 5 live tracks and 5 studio tracks. It's a good album, and it proved that B.B. King's increased exposure to young rock audiences was paying dividends, as Live and Well would become B.B. King's highest-selling album to that date when it was released. King quickly followed up that album later in 1969 with Completely Well. And in this case, this was a complete studio album.
Yeah, here I stand before you with my heart in my hand. I want you to read it, baby, hoping that you understand. I said, baby, honey, please don't dog me around, because I'd rather love you, woman, honey, than anyone else I know in town.
For the final track on Completely Well, B.B. King covered a song from 1951 that had originally been recorded by Roy Hawkins. The Thrill Is Gone would become King's breakthrough hit, rising to number 15 on the pop charts. And the Completely Well album quickly eclipsed the sales of his Live and Well album to become his new highest charting album at that time.
Well, I'm so excited, think about you all the time.
And the album would ultimately wind up being his fifth highest charting album of his entire career, as he had more success to come. Despite the magnificent career that B.B. King had before this song was released, The Thrill Is Gone wound up entrenching him and his guitar work into the overall American pop consciousness in an enduring way that he probably would have never obtained without this huge hit. The rest of the album is solid as well. B.B. King was at the heights of his power at this time, both as a guitar player and as a singer, and he put all of that on outstanding display on this great album. Let's listen to another song from this album now. Enjoy! And now, my number 8 favorite album of 1969, which was by Crosby, Stills, and Nash. And the album was titled Crosby, Stills, and Nash, yet another self-titled debut album on my list.
It's getting to the point where I'm no fun anymore.
I am sorry.
Sometimes it hurts so badly I must cry out loud.
I am lonely.
I am yours. You are mine. You are what you are.
Crosby, Stills, and Nash was a remarkable vocal album that is permanently etched into my DNA due to its repeated plays that it had in my childhood home. Besides the obvious beauty of the vocal harmonies on display by this group, I have always been blown away by the sound engineering on this debut album. The sound of every instrument and every voice is all so rich and distinct and warm. The warmth of this album sounds like a cocoon in which you could wrap yourself up for safety and comfort. Or perhaps that's merely the perception I get since I heard it so often when warm and safe in my own childhood home.
Helplessly hoping her harlequin hovers nearby, awaiting a word, gasping at glimpses of joy. gentle true spirit. He runs, wishing he could fly.
The star of this album was Stephen Stills. He recorded all of the lead guitar parts, as well as the keyboards and the bass guitar for this album. And he supplied the songwriting for the stunning brilliance of the song Sweet Judy Blue Eyes, as well as the outstanding song Helplessly Hoping. And Stills was also the songwriter for You Don't Have to Cry and 49 Bye-Byes.
49 reasons, all in a lie. All of them good ones, all of them lies. Drifting with my lady, we're oldest of friends. Need a little work and there's fences to mend.
Stills had also contributed to the writing of the song Wooden Ships, along with David Crosby and Paul Kantner. This song, appearing both on a Jefferson Airplane album as well as this Crosby, Stills, and Nash album.
Wooden ships on the water, very free and easy. Easy, you know the way it's supposed to be. Silver on the shoreline, let us be talking about very free and easy.
Stills was really exploding as a creative genius at this time in his life. David Crosby emerged on this album from the shadows of the Byrds, a group from which he had been fired in 1967. On this debut album, David Crosby displays a fiercely original personal vision for his own new music. The song Guinevere displayed Crosby's fantastic ability to write transfixing ballads that were easily accessible while also being structurally very complex, with odd tunings and unusual time signatures.
Guinevere had green eyes like yours, milady, like yours. She'd walk down through the garden in the morning after it rained.
David Crosby also contributes the great rocker Long Time Gone.
And it appears to be phenomenal. Appears to be phenomenal. Appears to be phenomenal.
It's a long, 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 long time before the dawn.
Though the strength of CSN has always been in its combination of voices, I've always personally heard David Crosby's voice as the foundation on which this musical house was built. His is the only of the three voices that I particularly enjoy to hear as a solo artist. Stephen Stills has made some outstanding singles as a solo artist, but I seldom enjoy his singing. And Graham Nash is an outstanding harmony singer, but I never particularly like his voice as the lead instrument. Graham Nash, however, was critically vital to the harmonies. He has a great ear for how to use his voice to support and uplift his partners. I respect that craft very much. And from what I have seen from Graham Nash in interviews and such, I personally like Graham Nash as a person and a celebrity. Of the group, he seems like the one that most has his head on straight, with the fewest character flaws. I do often fault Graham Nash's songwriting, though. I've often felt that Graham Nash's songwriting was the weak part of this group, even though he has contributed some of the group's biggest hits, and there are some deep cuts by him that I think are very good as well. But I still think that the overall quality of his songbook with this group is the weakest of the three members. On this particular album, I like the haunting quality of Graham Nash's song, Lady of the Island.
Holding you close, undisturbed before a fire. The pressure in my chest when you breathe in my ear. We both knew this would happen when you first appeared. My Lady of the Island.
And the song Pre-Road Downs isn't bad, but that song does feel a bit like a non-vital filler track. The song Marrakesh Express, on the other hand, I really can't stand at all. It was certainly a big hit, which I guess isn't a big surprise, because the song is a total empty pop confection. To me, Marrakesh Express sounds exactly like the type of musical rubbish that Graham Nash's previous band, The Hollies, was popular for, which is not a good thing in my tastes. I personally consider The Hollies to be one of the most overrated bands to ever make it into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I really don't like the catalog of that band at all. It's really the presence of the song Marrakesh Express that pulls this album this far down on my chart for this year. The remaining albums coming up on this countdown just don't have a song on them that I remotely dislike as much as I dislike Marrakesh Express. The song Sweet Judy Blue Eyes is perhaps best enjoyed outside of this album from the band's historic Woodstock concert, with that song being a highlight of the Woodstock movie documentary that they made. Woodstock wound up being just the second live appearance by CSN in public. By this time, the band had added Neil Young to the band, and they appeared with Neil Young at Woodstock for some songs, as well as performing some of the CSN material as a trio. In addition to Neil Young's assets as another strong songwriter for the group, and a thoroughly different vocal style to add into their mix, Neil Young was originally recruited due to the fact that he can play multiple instruments very well. So Neil Young could switch off on keyboards or electric guitar or acoustic guitar as needed for the live performances of the songs that Stills had played multiple instruments on through the wonders of multi-track recording, because obviously Stills couldn't play all of these instruments himself in live performance. Another highlight from this album is the song Wooden Ships, which I mentioned was a collaborative songwriting partnership between Stephen Stills, David Crosby, and Paul Kantner. I love the vocal work on Wooden Ships, and I admire the understated way that the lyrics subtly evoke visions of a post-apocalypse. And most of all, I love the bass and guitar tones that Stephen Stills developed for this song in the CSN recording of it. There's a tremendous dynamic range that is present on the vinyl versions of this album, and mostly make their way to CD media, which often loses some of that warmth of the analog music of this era. The bass tones on Wooden Ships played on a quality song system and its original vinyl mastering make this recording among my favorite bass guitar performances of all time. And on any good sound system, this recording just blows me away every single time I hear it. The guitar tones on the song are distinctive as well, and they help the song to truly take flight. I know that these type of statements might make me sound old, but it is exactly this type of recording that I find truly missing from today's musical landscape. There are so few music listeners that listen to their music in high fidelity quality on good audio equipment these days. So nobody bothers to put this much love and care into the engineering and mixing of today's music. everything's built around the predominant use of tinny earbuds and overly compressed musical samples that come from music streaming services. And so the audio engineers adjust accordingly to make the music sound as good as they can on that low-quality equipment, much in the same way that Phil Spector built his wall of sound music around mono recordings. And that's largely why Phil Spector's career as a pop hit maker came to an end with the advent of stereo. Anyway, let's listen to one more great song from this great album now. Enjoy!
Do you think of me and how you left me crying? Are you thinking of telephones and managers and where you got to be at noon? You are living a reality. I left years ago, it quite nearly killed me.
My number 7 favorite album of 1969 was by Jefferson Airplane, and the album was Volunteers. Paul Kantner, as I mentioned, had helped to write the song Wooden Ships, and thus that song is also included on this Jefferson Airplane album. The Airplane version of the song has a more harrowing and desperate quality to it than the CSN recorded version does.
You must try some of my purple berries. I've been eating them for 6 or 7 weeks now. Haven't got sick once.
Probably keep us both alive.
This would wind up being the final album by the classic lineup of Jefferson Airplane, with Marty Balin and Spencer Dryden leaving the band before their next album came out in 1971. But this lineup ended things on a very high note with this album.
Over on the other shore, stay out of the way of the bloodstained bandit. Oh, good shepherd.
Volunteers is an excellent album with an in-your-face, rebellious rock and roll spirit to it through and through. As the band says, "We are forces of chaos and anarchy. Everything they say we are, and we are very proud of ourselves." Those are part of the lyrics of the song We Can Be Together, one of the great anti-establishment rock songs in all of rock history. I have always loved that particular lyrical phrase and the way it unflinchingly acknowledges and owns any criticism that you may wish to throw at this band for its image and or behavior.
We are forces of chaos and anarchy. Everything they say we are, and we are very proud of ourselves. Up against the wall, up against the wall, on your fucking tear down the wall.
The song also contains the line, "In order to survive, we steal, cheat, lie, forge, fuck, hide, and deal." The band wound up appearing on the Dick Cavett TV show immediately after their appearance at the Woodstock Music Festival. This line of "We Can Be Together" managed to slip past the network censors and was broadcast unbleeped, It is believed by historians to be the first time in history that the word fuck had ever actually been broadcast.
We're all outlaws in the eyes of America. In order to survive, we steal, cheat, lie, forge, fuck, hide, and deal. We're obscene, lawless, hideous, dangerous, dirty, violent.
If you watch videos of that TV appearance, you'll also see a brief glimpse of Joni Mitchell at the start of the video on YouTube. This is the TV show that Joni Mitchell's record company had insisted that she make an appearance on and insisted that she skip Woodstock in order to ensure that she would not miss the show. They wanted to make sure to be promoting her album to a national audience. As it turned out, even with all the travel chaos surrounding Woodstock, it hadn't interfered with the ability of the Jefferson Airplane, or for David Crosby and Stephen Stills to all make it to the TV studio in time to appear on this show. Joni Mitchell wound up being pretty irritated by that fact, and she always regretted having ceded to the wishes of her management team in canceling her appearance at Woodstock. Jefferson Airplane also wound up releasing a live album earlier in 1969. That album was titled Bless Its Pointed Little Head, and that album does do a good job of capturing the sound of the live Jefferson Airplane. I like that release as well, though it ultimately got cut out of my top 20 in favor of this album full of outstanding music and excellent songcraft by the band. Let's listen to one more song by the band here now. Enjoy!
Toad's name is Lightning, his head hangs out the shoulder. And if you give him sugar, you know, Winnie like a boulder. Yes, he will. Yes, it's good living on the farm. Oh, so good living on the farm. You know, it's so good living on this farm.
And now, my number 6 favorite album of 1969, which was The Band. And here we have yet another self-titled album. The album was called The Band, but in this case, it was not a debut album. This was the second album by The Band.
Lake Charles, Louisiana, little Bessie girl I once knew. And she told me just to come on by if there's anything that she could do. On Cripple Creek, she sends me if I spring a leak. She mends me, I don't have to speak. And she defends me a drunkard's dream if I ever did see one.
The band had spent the early part of their career as the backing band for Ronnie Hawk, and then later for Bob Dylan. The band had developed a style that was firmly entrenched in American roots music. And lyrically, the band often was focused on themes of older historic America. It had been a natural affinity for the band from its very start. But on this album, they made a deliberate focus of it that led to songs such as The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down.
Virgil, quick, come see, there goes Robert E. Lee. Now I don't mind chopping the
Well, the band were hugely influential in setting off a sea change in rock music at the time by leading a cultural shift away from complex psychedelia towards the emerging country rock style. The influence and importance of their music is still apparent within our more recent musical landscape. Popular bands of this new millennium, such as Mumford & Sons, The Lumineers, or Nathaniel Rateliff, are built on the foundations that the band laid. and many of today's jam bands incorporate Americana roots into their music that are majorly influenced by this group's great songbook.
Across the great divide, just grab your hat and take that ride. Get yourself a ride and bring your children down to the riverside. I had a goal in my younger days. I nearly wrote my will, but I changed my mind for the better.
This album is the band at their most focused and unified height of group creativity. Before drugs and band infighting over royalties began to fray the unified brotherhood within the band. This album is often cited as one of the greatest albums of all time, and I can't fault any of those. There's not really a weak moment on this album, and I love it unconditionally. Even though this band wasn't into the kind of extended live improvisations of the jam bands that I tend to love.
Leg, mama, leg, I can't believe it's true. Leg, mama, leg, what did you do? I crawled up to the railroad track like a 419 scratching my back.
But there's no doubt they were an extremely tight and invigorating musical force. Let's listen to another one of their great songs now. Enjoy!
Look out, Cleveland! Storm is coming through, and it's running right up on you. Look out, Houston! There'll be thunder on the hill. Bye-bye.
Next, my number 5 favorite album of 1969, which was by Quicksilver Messenger Service, and the album was Happy Trails. I can't say that I'm actually a big fan of Quicksilver Messenger Service's studio efforts. One of the reasons that Quicksilver never gained the level of acclaim that some of their San Francisco contemporaries did was due to their lack of truly exceptional original songs. However, on stage, Quicksilver Messenger Service was as vital a component of the San Francisco psychedelic sound as any of those bigger name bands. And this album captures the band at their most satisfying. Stretching out on a pair of Bo Diddley songs, a pair of their original songs, and summing it all up with a friendly little old cowboy traditional tune.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.
John Cipollina is one of the most criminally overlooked guitar players of his generation, and he meshed magnificently with Gary Duncan in a psychedelic interplay for this band. This is another one of those albums that received heavy play around my home during my childhood, and I believe it was extremely formative in my expectations of what guitars should sound like. This album also played a big part in my love of Bo Diddley, the music of whom I was introduced to via this band before I was ever old enough and informed enough to know who Bo Diddley was, or the huge influence that his music had on so many bands that I grew up loving. This is a great live album, and it plays right into my love of long extended psychedelic jams. But also underlines it with my love of a solid groove, which any Bo Diddley beat song is always going to have. Let's listen to a little bit more from this band now. Enjoy! Girl, you ought to listen to my heart going bumpity-bump, bumpity-bump. But well, I need you, baby, and it ain't no lie. My number four favorite album of 1969 was by Neil Young with Crazy Horse, and the album was Everybody Knows This Is Nowhere. I wanna live with a cinnamon girl. I can be happy the rest of my life with a cinnamon girl. A dreamer. I run in the night. You see us together, chasing the moonlight, my cinnamon girl. This was Neil Young's second album since having left Buffalo Springfield, and it was his first album with Crazy Horse as his backing band. It was released a mere 4 months after his poorly produced solo debut album. Neil Young's creative mind was positively on fire as he produced some of the biggest showstopper songs of his career. She could drag me over the rainbow, send me away. Down by the river, I shot my baby. And when I say his mind was on fire, I mean it literally. Neil Young was sick with a fever of 103 degrees when he wound up writing the songs Cinnamon Girl, Down by the River, Cowgirl in the Sand, and Everybody Knows This Is Nowhere, all in the same day. I think I'd like to go back home and take it easy. There's a woman that I'd like to get.
living there. And everybody seems to wonder what it's like down here. I gotta get away from this day to day running around. Everybody knows this is nowhere.
After the attempted slick production, and botched production, in my opinion, of Neil Young's solo debut album, this second album by him came as a major change in direction. His backing band Crazy Horse was loose, muddy, and rough, the original grunge rock band.
I went into town to see you yesterday, but you were not. So I talked to some old friends for a while before I wandered off.
Musical trends have come and gone over the past 54 years, and this album has continued to sound fresh and important through all of those. The songs Cinnamon Girl and Down by the River are the two most played songs from this album. But my favorite song has always been the epic jams that Crazy Horse supplies for live takes on the song Cowgirl in the Sand, and the studio version on this album is excellent as well. So let's end this segment with a little bit of a clip of Cowgirl in the Sand. Enjoy!
Hello, cowgirl in the sand.
Hello, cowgirl in the sand.
Is this place at your command?
And now, my number three favorite album of 1969, which was by the Rolling Stones, and the album was Let It Bleed.
We all need someone we can bleed on.
Let It Bleed is the middle album in a three-album peak run of flawless recordings by the Rolling Stones. Their best three albums, in my opinion, are 1968's Beggar's Banquet, this one from 1969, and 1971's Sticky Fingers. Let It Bleed is a transitional album for the band, as it started out being recorded with Brian Jones. And since the recording sessions were sporadic, it ended after Jones had been removed from the band. And unfortunately, shortly after that, Brian Jones died. The Rolling Stones replaced Brian Jones with Mick Taylor. Given the length of time it took to record this album, the issues with Brian Jones at the time, and the ultimate change of guitar players, one might have expected a bit of a haphazard album to come out of those sessions. However, not only did the Stones use their own internal demons as creative inspiration, but they also wound up probably being the most successful band of the era in properly capturing the darker side of their times. An era with a controversial war, protests in the streets, and the recent assassinations in 1968. The results of the Stones' creativity at that time are an impressively cohesive, deep dive into the American roots music style, including blues, country, and gospel influences.
can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. But if you try sometimes, well, you might find.
This album is a flawless cycle of songs that, to me, often seems overlooked by albums like Sticky Fingers, and even more irritating to me by Exile on Main Street, which I have revealed before I'm not actually a huge fan of. I love a ton of the songs on Exile on Main Street, but I do not like the production quality on that album very much. And so I am not one that counts that as part of the run of Stone's classic albums. I think that album is overrated, and I think Let It Bleed is tragically underrated.
Did you hear about the midnight?
I will take Let It Bleed over Exile on Main Street any day of the week. Let's listen to another great song off this album now. Enjoy!
I'm a pretty 15 at Monkey.
Now we get to my number two favorite album of 1969, and it was by my all-time favorite band, The Grateful Dead. The album was Live Dead.
Gathers what another man spills.
Live Dead perfectly captures the majestic beauty and cosmic journey of a Grateful Dead show during an era in which the band was pushing at the boundaries of musical form and structure and reinventing the concert-going experience from the ground up. The Grateful Dead also released their weirdest studio album in 1969. Adding to the overall weird quality of this year that I noted in my initial reviews a couple episodes back. That album was Oxymoxoa. I did not give Oxymoxoa serious consideration for a spot in my top 20 list. While the album is an intellectually interesting one, Robert Hunter wasn't yet hitting on all cylinders as a lyricist for the band. I'm not a big fan of the song Doin' That Rag, nor of Cosmic Charlie, much less the strange songs Rosemary and What's Become of the Baby. Those last two songs sound a bit like The Grateful Dead was trying to be Pink Floyd, and it doesn't really fit their vibe very well. Saint Stephen is a decent song with a very strong, iconic guitar hook, though I'm not as big a fan of that song as many other Deadheads seem to be. I always been much more excited when the band would transition out of St. Stephen into The Eleven. The Eleven was not on Oxymoxoa, but it does show up on Live Dead, along with a very good live version of St. Stephen. The songs Mountains of the Moon and Dupree's Diamond Blues on Oxamoxoa are both great songs that give a sense of the old weird America themes that Robert Hunter has been rightly applauded for exploring. And the song China Cat Sunflower from Oxamoxoa is among the earliest of the Hunter Garcia masterpiece songs. However, the most important early Hunter Garcia collaboration is found only on this live album. There was, however, a silly short studio version of the song that was actually released as a single, but Dark Star never appeared on a studio album by the Grateful Dead. Instead, Dark Star was presented in all of its jaw-dropping glory on Live Dead, taking up the entire first side of this double album. The adventurous early Deadheads quickly adopted the psychedelic odyssey of Dark Star as their tribal theme song, and they would ask the band simply to play it, and everybody knew what it meant. It meant play Dark Star. The album side with Dark Star alone makes Live Dead a must-listen for any Deadhead. But then, on top of Dark Star, side two of this album adds in an outstanding version of St. Stephen into The Eleven. The Eleven is one of the most intricate and tricky pieces of band interplay that the Grateful Dead ever produced. The song was written in an 11/8 time signature, and the song, in my opinion, would always bring the very best out of Phil Lesh's unique bass style, in which Phil Lesh tended to play like another lead player instead of staying down in the rhythmic pocket that most bass players occupy. Side three of this double album has a long rave-up version of Turn On Your Love Light with a trademark pigpen rap segment to the audience.
I want to tell you how come she made her feel so good. Yes, she do. Yes, she do. I know to make her feel all right. Yes, she do. She got box back knitted, great big and over back, working undercover with her phone hung out.
Then side four features Jerry Garcia's unique ability to make a dark dirge blues song into an epiphany with his take on the folk classic, Death Don't Have No Mercy.
Death will leave you standing and crying in this land.
With that song segueing into Feedback, the chaotic early ancestor to the Grateful Dead's later space segments in concert. And after Feedback, the album ends with a gentle landing lullaby into We Bid You Good Night to end the album.
I love you, oh, but Jesus loves you the best, and I bid you good night. Good night. Good night.
Live Dead is a perfect album, and it took something extremely exceptional to knock it out of the top spot. After all, this is a live album by my favorite live band of all time, and I will reveal what has done that after we listen to one more segment of the Grateful Dead here now. Enjoy!
Yeah.
And now, finally, my number one favorite album of 1969, which was by a little obscure indie band known as The Beatles. The album was Abbey Road. Abbey Road was the final recorded album for the Fab Four, though Get Back, an album that the Beatles had recorded in tension-filled sessions earlier in the year, but had struggled to complete, would eventually get released the following year under the title of Let It Be. In the wake of those unpleasant Get Back sessions, the Beatles brought back producer George Martin and tried to create a new album with him the way they used to do it, as George Martin had requested.
Oh, darling, please believe me. I'll never do you no harm. Believe me when I tell you.
The contrasting production styles of the two sides of Abbey Road were a compromise between John Lennon's wish for a traditional rock and roll album and McCartney and Martin's desire for continued studio experimentation in the mold of the Sgt. Pepper album. So for side one of Abbey Road, you wind up with a couple of heavy John Lennon rockers bookending that side of the album, with the songs Come Together at the start and the song I Want You, She's So Heavy ending side one. In between that is a McCartney rave up, Oh Darling, and a particularly dark McCartney novelty song, Maxwell's Silver Hammer.
Bang, bang, Maxwell's silver hammer came down upon her head. Bang, bang, Maxwell's silver hammer made sure that she was dead.
But these songs were also broken up on the side by the album's divine second song, Something. Something was George Harrison's most celebrated composition. Even Frank Sinatra professed admiration for this song and would record it.
Something in the way she moves attracts me like no other lover.
And to round out side one is a Ringo-led novelty song, Octopus's Garden, which was an original actually written by Ringo himself.
I'd like to be under the sea in an octopus's garden in the shade.
cousin knows where we've been, in his octopus's garden in the shade. I'd ask my friends to come and see an octopus's garden with me.
Side two of Abbey Road starts out with another Harrison gem, with the song Here Comes the Sun. Here Comes the Sun has a rich and warm production sheen that pervades the second side of Abbey Road.
Here comes the sun, here comes the sun, I say it's all right.
The second song on this side of Abbey Road is John Lennon's Because.
Because the world is round, it turns me on. Because the world is round.
Because is not formally considered to be part of the famous Abbey Road medley on side two. But in my mind, Because has always been linked to that medley. And the medley to me always sounds like it starts off wrong these days. If McCartney in concert or anybody else plays the medley starting with the song You Never Give Me Your Money rather than starting with the song Because.
You never give me.
It is the second side medley that transforms Abbey Road from merely being another great Beatles album to being what I consider to be the band's absolute masterpiece. It's in the sequencing of the songs, the superb production decisions of George Martin, the excellence of the band's musical interplay, that make the most out of each song snippet, and adds color and drama to each one so that you never feel the fact that this musical collage is largely made up of unfinished song snippets. This great album has beguiled me since my earliest childhood memories. An increased experience with music and the world in general has only helped me to appreciate its rich mysteries even more. When I left home for college many years ago, the tape of Abbey Road was one of the tapes that I stole from my parents' record collection. When I bought my first CD player, Abbey Road was one of the first five CDs that I bought that same day to listen to on my new player. And when I bought myself a turntable again several years ago and dusted off the small box of remaining LPs from my storage shed, Abbey Road was the first album that I cleaned up to play on it.
Sing a lullaby.
The Beatles also released the soundtrack to the Yellow Submarine movie in 1969. Half of that album is taken up by orchestral soundtrack songs, and thus, the album pretty much is my least favorite Beatles album. So it's interesting that in this final year of the Beatles' existence, they managed to come out with both what is my favorite as well as what is my least favorite of their great catalog of albums. Let's listen to one more song off of Abbey Road here to end this episode. I hope you've all enjoyed this review of 1969. If you have any questions, comments, criticisms, or just want to say hi, you can send email to tony@roadtojamnation.com, or you can join my Facebook group, Road to Jam Nation, or you can also find me on the social media platform now known as X, where I go under my actual name of Tony Kurilic. I hope you'll all return next week when I will begin a multi-episode look at the music of 2023. Now, here's the Beatles. Enjoy!
Take is equal.